Found a scale faster on Deel. Set up payroll for any country in minutes, hire anyone anywhere, get visas handled fast, and get back to building. Visit deel.com/day1. That's deel.com/day1.
Building a headset that uses ultrasonic pulses to induce lucid dreams.
Oh, I want that. Patients sitting in a chair, there's a neural interface or a screen in front of them. They're not moving their lips, but it's typing out their thoughts in front of them. Is this fact or fiction? Is this sci-fi? Is this real? Did I make that up?
No, that's real. That can actually happen now. Definitely.
What kinds of diseases do you think AI will solve before scientists?
There won't be diseases become cured that don't in some way involve machine learning and artificial intelligence. If we bet long term, you know, in 100 years, this is going to either, you know, if we're around, this is going to be happening. How is it going to be happening? Well, people are going to have electrodes in the brain.
Seeing Neuralink going after this, will Grok be the best model to use? I told you it was spicy.
Hello and welcome to In the Blink of AI. I'm Georgie Healy and we are going into the future. This is going to sound like illegal sci-fi stuff, but it's actually happening. We're talking about brain interfacing. And basically, the way you type in the future is not going to be with your keyboard. Today, we have Josh Vinson. He casually confirms something that sounds mildly illegal to me. A patient can sit still and not move their lips, and a screen will type out their thoughts. This is real. This is happening. This has happened. This is going to continue to happen. And we talk about the invasive and non-invasive ways this is happening through AI, through the technology revolution that we're currently in, and the big players in this space. Josh is really passionate about the non-invasive techniques, and he's really passionate about something called experience transfer. You're going to have to listen to hear that part. Mild warning, we do kind of get into where those wires are getting poked. So if you're a little bit on the queasy side about that stuff, might want to skip ahead for those. But if you really want practical insights into how brain signals are going to predict treatment options in the future, how they're going to help solve some of those neurological diseases that have long been big question marks for scientists, this is an incredible episode. I was so thrilled to have Josh on the show. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to a day1.fm show.
I'm thrilled to be partnered with Stripe for today's episode. Did you know that Stripe Startups offers early stage venture-backed startups access to Stripe fee credits, expert insights, and a focused community of builders? We love builders on In the Blink of AI. Apply today at day1.fm/stripe.
We're going to start officially with hacks of the week.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to kick us off. I had a hack of the week. I was very happy with this one. And then I had to completely change tack because I have started properly using voice activation across my laptop, like not within an LLM, but things like Whisperflow, Super Whisper. You download Whisper. Have you used these?
No. But I've seen lots of stuff about Flow, and I think that's like a potentially really interesting way to interact with a computer, except that you need to be in a space where you can talk out loud.
This is true. And apparently like having headphones in really helps with this and background noise and things like that.
Yeah, but then you can like, would you be annoying other people? I guess if everyone's got headphones in.
Oh yeah, I don't care about that
okay,
so
well, that's
much.
Good. Yeah, that's good.
That's their problem.
Yeah.
No, I was speaking to Gareth from Fryer. They help small business owners. And I was very cheeky and I was kind of like, I think I know all the AI tools. I think I'm across it all. And I had not tried this before, and he shared his screen with me. And anytime you've got a cursor, you can just kind of talk instead of typing. He's like, I didn't bring out my keyboard all day.
Wow.
Cool, right?
Very cool. Yes. I think it's going to be really interesting to explore all the different ways that we can like supersede the mouse and keyboard. I actually think that neural decoding and brain computer interfaces are going to be the kind of final form of that.
Yeah.
So, but
well,
yeah.
Why even talk? Just think.
Yeah,
it.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's like completely private to you as well.
And private.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is my big hot prediction for the year is more and more people are going to start getting away from the keyboard and mouse construct that we kind of had to do to interact with the hardware and computers.
And this is like maybe a bit of an AI Luddite thought, but like how do you code with Whisper Flow? I guess the answer is you don't. You talk to Claude Code or Codex and then...
Think vibe coding you could do with voice, but not so much.
Yeah, interesting.
Okay, what's your hack of the week?
I would say I'm probably like behind the frontier with respect to using like AI tools and stuff in my workflow. My hack, I thought about this a little bit, would be I think that the Codex and Claude Code and all of that, like all of those like AI coding tools are really, really good at taking like, so a lot of, some of my work is just writing data processing scripts, which is like doesn't require any interesting thought processes. It's just like your data's in this format, needs to be in this format, and there's lots of like format A, and you're trying to get them all to be a common format. And if you write one function that does it, and then you're like, okay, now look at all of these other databases and try and like emulate this function, but for them, can churn that out. And it's like days, would have been like days of work for me in like 10 minutes.
Are you using a specific tool with this? Have you tried different tools for this?
I kind of bounce between Codex and Claude Code depending on vibes.
And what vibes are the vibes?
How many times do they not do the thing that I want well? And then I'm like, and then also you just like see on Twitter, like people like, oh, this new like Opus, what is it? Like 4.5.
Everyone keeps talking about
and then,
it.
Like, but then like OpenAI come up with like GPT 5.2 and then it's like, yeah, kind of just follow that. But I mean, it's getting to the point now where they're just both insanely good.
This is it, right?
And yeah, I mean, I haven't had a moment in a long time. I mean, to be again, I don't use them that much, but when I use them, I guess partly because I know exactly what they're good for, I'm just like, oh my God.
These leaderboards are crazy, right? Yeah. Because can't keep on top of it.
No, it's moving so quickly.
And to your point, they're all excellent.
Yeah. Yeah, particularly now. I feel like we're really like we've hit this like inflection point where they're not making these like dumb, really obvious mistakes anymore. Yeah. And they like they'll run the code for you now. And then if it doesn't work, you know, they'll correct it and they'll write tests for you. And, you know, it's just like it's crazy.
Yeah.
And vibes of the company.
And vibes of the company.
Yeah, you're just like voting with your money. You're like, who do I like more?
Oh, and the headlines of like who's left the company recently, which AI engineers are like mass exodus from companies.
Yeah, who's working
tend
where?
To make me be like, oh, something's happening. Something's bad.
Yep.
I heard that OpenAI, it was a Twitter quote, so like take this very seriously, everyone. But said, guys, my OpenAI friend just got a housemate. Be worried.
Oh, yes.
Did you see this? Yeah.
Sell everything.
there's blood on the water, guys. Yeah. All right. I have a rant of the week. I've never done this before, but I do think increasingly I want to be not just an AI sycophant that just only tells good stories in AI. I heard about this last year. I wanted to get on the show and tell people, please don't do this. My personal opinion. I'm hearing that people were using AI to generate an image of Santa within their actual living room to show their kids and be like, look, Santa came. I get the ick from this so badly, Josh, because I feel like there's already trust issues with AI. Mm. I don't like the kid involvement in the fakery of imagery. I just feel deeply uncomfortable with the privacy and the security aspect of your home and then creating like essentially a deep fake. Do you get the ick or is it just me? Because I was listening to a show where everyone was sharing that they did that and they seem to all be fine with it. What am I missing?
Well, where my mind immediately goes is like you're just creating more and more sophisticated lies to tell your kids, right? There's a difference between like, oh, hey, like I know how we told you that Santa brought these presents here, but actually we did it versus like that photo that you saw of Santa. Like when a kid kind of grows up learning that any photo or like has to, you know, go through the realization that any photo they have seen could have potentially been faked.
Yes. Just a reminder for us all to kind of stay vigilant with what we're doing. And just because you see a trending, be careful in the AI space, I think.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of things like that where people, I mean, I don't know. I always nerd snipe myself into thinking too deeply about things. But I feel like there's like an argument to be made that, oh, we should really, you know, be thinking more about like the consequences of our actions, more steps, like steps into the future about like, oh, if we do this, then this is going to happen.
Yeah, I do agree.
In the way that we use these tools.
I do agree with the recent social media ban for under 16s. That's like a reaction to what we were noticing and things playing out that way. I am guilty of sometimes not thinking things through. You know, I've got a partner that was very against us putting our kids on social media, and I fully agreed with friends that were pro it and had private accounts and being okay with that as well. And sometimes you just don't know until you see things play out, and then you're like, oh, we probably shouldn't have done that and things like that. And I need to start thinking more is my 2026 goal.
But it's like, it's almost impossible because these like new technologies are coming out. They're having new consequences that are harder and harder to predict.
Yeah. Let's dive into your kind of domain background and experience. We've never gone into this space before on the show. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited to chat to you. I'm just going to paint a little bit of a picture. A patient sitting in a chair, there's a neural interface or a screen in front of them. They're not moving their lips, but it's typing out their thoughts in front of them. Is this fact or fiction? Is this sci-fi? Is this real? Did I make that up?
No, that's real. That can actually happen now, definitely.
Are you lying?
No. No, that's the thing that people can do for sure.
And it's been proven? And tell me kind of about the proof and how it's been proven. Like, are scientists writing papers on this?
Yeah.
Like, how far between academic and in universities and they're proving it from that scale and actual patients being able to use this safely?
I think it's all very research stage at the moment. And like, there's a gulf between like something being a demonstration in a lab, even a really good one, and like actually deployed in the world. People can, you know, it's in the market, people can buy it, or it becomes part of like normal healthcare. But I think we're kind of moving between those two worlds now. This is like becoming a reliable enough demo in a lab that we can start to think about, how do we commercialize this? How does it get applied to people's lives? Who needs it?
And what do you call this space? Because I'm calling it neuroscience plus AI. Is that what you would call it? What is this?
I mean, the overarching umbrella term is like brain-computer interfaces.
Okay.
Which is like, how do you take signals from a brain and then give them to computers in ways that computers can interpret them and take actions based on them?
And to dive a bit deeper, are we saying you think a thought, it types the thought, just like the voice AI I'm talking about, or is it predicting our next thought even, like an LLM?
Well, that's a complicated question. It's like there's a continuum there. When you are thinking about things, when you're constructing language in your mind, there's like or when you're speaking, there's an element, like you're speaking sequentially, but your brain is not operating sequentially. There's kind of there is a predictive process there. There's a sense in which you've kind of already formed a sentence before you've said it. When these models are extracting information from your brain, they can kind of do both, right? Mm. You can get like the words as they come, but you know, it's hard to say because it's not even really clear yet how, or at least I'm not super familiar with how the words are constructed in your, like, so the thing that like cognitive psychologists talk about when they talk about like thoughts in your head is called the phonological loop, which is like the part of like your working memory that deals with like your inner monologue. And it's, you know, there's like, we've carved out like that this is a thing that, I mean, obviously like a lot of people can do this. Some people can't, allegedly. And then you're like, these models potentially are extracting information from it. What that information looks like is kind of an open question. Is it like word by word by word? Can we get that level of detail? Or is it more like sentence, you know, at a time? But yeah, there's a continuum between like extracting things that are happening live in your brain versus predicting, right? And the extent to which the prediction is happening in your brain versus in the model. Obviously, like LLMs are in some sense word predictors.
Yes.
And like you could start a sentence and then the model could be pretty sure based on its understanding of, you know, human language, but then also where your brain is kind of, what your brain is doing about how you're going to finish it, maybe even before you're consciously aware of it.
You're reminding me of when I was in France and trying to learn French the hard way, which is like arrive in the country and start to speak it. And there were certain sentences like, how are you, are you come after it? But then there's sentences I say or think, and in my mind, having not studied this, that I've never said before in my life. And I've constructed these four words together that I've never said before, like brain computer interface. I've never said those three words together. Like, surprise.
Yeah.
So this whole space, like, we're still figuring it out. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, neuroscience is far from solved.
Yeah.
And I think if any, we're going to get any, like, one of the really interesting things we're going to get out of neural decoding, which is kind of the act of passing neural signals into a machine learning model for the purposes of understanding them semantically, is we're going to probably learn a lot about what the brain is actually doing. But, you know, obviously cognitive neuroscience has made a lot of progress, and there are lots of interesting studies that point in certain directions and give hints about, you know, how language is constructed in the brain. I would say we quite know quite a lot about that, but it's not, yeah, we're far from a complete description yet.
You got a psychology background, right? But you're an AI engineer.
Yeah.
Good mix, I'd say.
Yeah.
Great mix. What, like, why? yeah, Jeffrey Hinton.
I'm not 2. Comparing 0. Myself.
You heard it here first, guys. Australia's own Jeffrey Hinton on the show.
That's not what I meant.
What would you love to solve, and what are you really passionate about solving specifically in the space?
I think I am, I mean, there's so much, right? I mean, partly I'm just very interested about how the brain works, and I think that this is just a great way to understand it, and like also have something practical come out of it. And I think that, you know, when you do kind of like pure cognitive science and cognitive neuroscience research, you run this danger of like being too abstracted away from the world, and you're kind of, everything is very theoretical and you can find evidence for it, but then like you're not actually connecting that back to the world and putting it, you know, demonstrating its utility by putting it into something that's acting in the world. And that's like, then you risk learning nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So by creating these models and putting them into to work as in medicine or in research, or, you know, as a kind of a product, you kind of validate the things that you think you're learning about the brain. From the perspective of like, what would I like to solve? I think that one of the really interesting kind of terminal technologies here is like experience transfer. I think like mapping between two people's brains and like being able to have this like, not necessarily higher bandwidth, but like very information dense, like very rich representation transfer between like people's brains. Like,
so imagine, I've just come back from Venice.
Yep.
And I'm trying to explain it to you, but yeah, it's really hard.
Yes, exactly.
Water everywhere.
Yep.
In your mind, what are you thinking?
Yeah.
Experience transfer. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Or like sometimes the example I use is like when I love music, and when I send people songs, you know, I'm kind of almost trying to communicate an experience that I'm having, and like, you know, the proxy, like the way to, I'm trying to instantiate that experience in someone's mind by having them listen to the same song, which like probably is not, you know, everyone's so different in kind of important ways. So that probably doesn't, you know, sometimes it resonates, sometimes it doesn't. But now imagine I can just send how the song makes me feel.
Oh, I wish I could send you how the Oasis in Sydney concert felt, because that was excellent.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, that, and we have, you know, all sorts of like really rich experiences which language kind of fail to articulate.
Wow, that's incredible. Okay, challenges. Mm-hmm. What do people get wrong when it comes to, well, what I've written here is neural decoding. Is that the same thing, or is that something different?
Neural decoding is the thing that I'm kind of interested in and working on, okay, which is how do you take brain signals and turn them into semantic insights about what, you know, what state is that person in, what intent, like motor or otherwise intentions do they have, basically just like understanding their mind by taking signals from the brain.
What's the hardest part? Like if you had to, I'm sure there's a lot that's hard.
Yeah.
But if you were like, man, this might not work, what is the reason why it might not work?
The two kind of like things that you kind of, you learn very early on when you're doing this kind of stuff is that there is a huge amount of variance. So you need some kind of way of extracting the signals from the brain. And that, so you have a device, you know, it's either non-invasive, so it sits outside of the cranium, the skull, or it's invasive and it comes inside the cranium. And like those devices themselves have a huge amount of variance.
The hardware itself.
Yes, exactly. And so like your model has to be able to ingest from ideally different pieces of hardware, because you kind of want your thing to generalize across, you know, different people or different devices.
Different skull shapes, different...
Yeah, but even just like the electrodes, you know, have like, or the sensors have like different kind of tolerances in their manufacturing process, which leads to like different amounts of noise and different like sensitivities that you can't really get rid of. So that's one thing, is like hardware variance. And then the other thing is interpersonal variance. And this is something I think about a lot. Like, is like, to what degrees are our brains actually, can you construct a map between them? Can you actually, you know, are they generally understandable?
Mm.
And then like, we've come a long way here. There's a lot of interesting papers that show, like, obviously you have degrees to which you can train a model on a bunch of people and then put another, have another person's brain data be interpretable by the model.
Yes.
And then you all pretty much always lose some performance.
Yes.
And I am really curious about like what that performance loss actually is, what the interpersonal component of that performance loss is, and to what degree do you, like, how do you correct for that?
Have you started changing the way you think about your own thoughts since coming into this space? Because I feel like as a deep thinker, I'm getting the sense you're a deep thinker already. Have you started kind of second order analyzing your thoughts since getting into this?
Well, I mean, I think related to what I was just talking about, the thing that I think about a lot more is, how different are we, and how different are our representations of things, and like, what does that mean for communication normally? Like, I think that, you know, when you talk to someone, and have you ever had that experience? I mean, I feel like everyone's had the experience where you're talking to someone and you think you're getting across what you're getting across, and then all of a sudden, like, they ask a question or they say something and you're like, oh, you're actually on a completely different page to me.
Yes.
And I think that that's interesting and potentially like circumventable with this technology, but it also just makes me think, like, how different are we really? Like, how different are our representations of things? But I've always been thinking about that. I think that it's just now, it's like a practical importance, because I have to understand how to overcome that in order to have these models be effective.
So if we could experience transfer and kind of experience paint the picture more than just the words could, you think communication could get better between people? Do you think we could solve world peace? I'm being silly, but genuinely, like, would it be better in like negotiations and things like that if people understood each other a little bit better?
Maybe. I mean, there's also a degree to which, like, in a negotiation, you want to hide information from the other person that they could, you know, use or so. Yeah, that is, I have honestly not thought about that, other than, you know, the technology is like an interesting thing to exist. But I think that's like, we have no idea where this is going to take us. In a similar way to like, you know, as artificial intelligence kind of progresses and it becomes more and more clear that, you know, these things are going to be able to do like economically useful work, like what's downstream of that is really hard to predict. I think what's downstream of really, really advanced applications of neural decoding is incredibly hard to predict. And like, for example, a relationship, like that's like an interesting thing that I wonder what, you know, what kind of changes if you just immediately know exactly what, where the other person's coming from and you don't lose information in a conversation.
My friends and I always talk about like people's different love languages, like, you know, the words of affirmation versus gifts versus this versus that.
Yep.
And it's like, I'm giving you so many gifts.
Yep.
Why are you not giving me gifts back? Oh, because I'm giving you words of affirmation.
Yes.
That's how I show love and care of people I care about, you know?
Yep. And you, like, yeah, exactly. Because, and there's so much, like, everything is kind of differently salient to different people. And so, like, you know, people who don't, for example, to continue on the kind of love language thing, people who don't, you know, aren't kind of as accustomed to gifts as part of their love language, then don't also probably see gifts with as much salience and so then don't appreciate the significance of it.
But if I could give you my experience of when I receive a gift and how much that makes me think that you care about me, it's like, whoa, okay, I'll give you gifts. Like, sure. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And in the AI of it all, could this technology have existed 5-10 years ago? How much has that progressed, this work?
Oh, massively. I think there are like two, so LLMs and things like that have given two things. One, they've given like a blueprint for like, oh, this is how you create very powerful general models. And, you know, I mean, like that scale works and things like that are really interesting insights that can now just be applied broadly to, and are being applied broadly to different modalities. And then also, I think for example, for like the decoding thoughts thing, it is like really useful to have to build on the back of a model that already deeply understands language and has good priors over what kind of sentences get formed, understand syntax and all that stuff to make it readable. Like it's possible that information is to some degree not available with, for example, like a non-invasive brain computer interface, and then having the model bridge that gap is going to be like invaluable.
I'm sure the listeners will be dying for this before I get to the next part. When you say invasive versus non-invasive, like I'm imagining the headsets that I've seen with the wires that are connected to the skull.
Yep.
What's invasive?
Well, invasive are like things like Neuralink, where you cut open the skull and you insert electrodes directly into the brain.
And that doesn't freak you out?
Oh, it freaks me out massively.
Okay, good.
Yeah. No, I...
You said that really straight face.
Well, I'm so used to thinking about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's... I mean, I am personally very bullish on non-invasive for like lots of different reasons, but partly because I think that the idea of opening the skull and putting electrodes into the brain is actually it's dangerous, but also it's in some sense like potentially irreversible. Not all, you know, as the technology advances, there'll be, you know, degrees to which we can, like it will matter less, but like you can't have, if the electrodes are in the brain, the electrodes are in the brain, you can't take it off.
Really?
I mean, it depends. Like you could design, for example, the system so that you could like unplug it or something and guarantee that it's not recording information. But like you can't pull electrodes in and out of the brain willy-nilly. That's like a procedure that you don't want to do a lot.
Is it easier to insert than uninsert? I don't know if that's a word.
So I'm not super up to speed on this because I'm so kind of excited about non-invasive technologies. Yeah. I haven't spent a long time looking at or thinking about invasive things. I think that it's partly an engineering problem. And, you know, I mean, Neuralink are doing really interesting things to solve it in terms of like automatic robotic surgeries. And, you know, robots are really good at, you know,
precision.
Doing. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And adapting to things like where's the vasculature in the brain so that we can insert electrodes and make sure they don't, you know, go through arteries and things like that and cause brain bleeds. The electrodes are getting smaller and less, more biocompatible. You know, a big problem was like it used to be the case that you would insert electrodes and like cysts or scar tissue would form around it, or like the brain would like have like an immune response, and then that would effectively render the electrodes useless. There's worlds upon worlds of complexity in invasive technologies. Yeah, there are, you know, kind of for every problem there's potentially a solution. At some point I think that there are like unsolvable problems. Like you can't just have the brain. I mean, there's a limit to the number of electrodes you can insert into the brain, right? The skull is kind of a closed thing. You have limited space. You can't just like thread electrodes.
There's only so much surface area, right? Well, yeah.
But these go into the brain, right? So there's only so much volume.
Ugh.
Yeah. And then, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter how small they are. Like you're not going to get them to slide in between neurons. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, I'm always very tentative because I'm like, who knows what people
Until
are going to come
do.
Up with.
Yeah.
But assuming you can't do that, you're always going to be like killing brain cells in the process. Mm. And so right now the technology is kind of limited to people whose, you know, quality of life is insufficient or, you know, bad enough that they then are happy to take the, you know, risk trade-off.
Yes.
And the question will be, and this is kind of one of the big things in terms of like invasive versus non-invasive is, does it become safe and reliable enough that the risk is so low that the rewards that you get from having electrodes in your brain for a person who's otherwise has, you know, reasonable quality of life, do they outweigh the kind of risks? And I think Neuralink are effectively, that's the bet that they're making, is that there's a huge market for people who, you know, need this technology because, you know, they're quadriplegic or they're blind or something. And then there will be the kind of, you know, as they kind of continue to develop the technology, I suspect that they, you know, and this is something that like Musk talks about all the time, and people who do not have these certain kinds of disabilities will also want the implant
to optimize
their lives. because it will provide them something that they otherwise can't have, you know, like to interface in an incredibly high bandwidth with a computer, to, you know, have these, you know, experience transfers but with maybe artificial intelligences or something.
So Musk is bullish on this, like he's really into it.
I think that, look, it's always very difficult to work out exactly his motivations, especially now. I mean, one of the things that they talked about a lot in reference to starting the company was to, you know, high bandwidth BCIs for the purposes of like connecting people and AIs. And I imagine that that, you know, that was probably the North Star. And then they were like, okay, how are we going to, like, if we bet long-term, you know, in 100 years, this is going to either, you know, if we're around, this is going to be happening. How is it going to be happening? Well, people are going to have electrodes in the brain.
Okay. I mean, it's so clear the risks from a physical standpoint. Yep. And you've touched upon the benefits and why Neuralink are going after what they are.
Mm-hmm.
I know that this is a side slight tangent, but there's a lot of really, like, my grandfather had MS. It was mm-hmm. really sad and really horrible mm-hmm. to see. We don't know how or why MS comes in some people and not others. Maybe that science is evolving. Do you see AI involved in these kind of more complex diseases that we haven't been able to solve and solve them faster?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's like the medium term holy grail here. Is
medium,
like,
term, not even long term.
Yeah. I mean, you know, timelines are hard to predict. Yeah. But I really think that like one of the major component, like markets for this and applications to this technology in like the things that you can be working on right now, like experience transfer is lofty and, you know, it's interesting. It's not particularly important. It's just like it's an amazing thing that, you know, that like makes sense in like a post-scarcity world. But like in, you know, in a world where, you know, people are suffering from neurological and psychiatric illnesses, that's the thing that, you know, has a huge, there's a huge possibility to you know, diagnose, to treat, to monitor, to understand like different subclasses of these different illnesses.
If there's anything on the top of your mind in terms of papers or emerging studies, is there anything that you're like, this might be coming soon?
I think that the early work, the work that's coming out now that I'm quite interested in is, it's like providing deeper understanding about all these different illnesses. I think that psychiatry is a very, and this is, I don't know, I mean, you know, the feedback from this might be negative, but it's an immature science, and it kind of is, it's, I think it's imprecise and it's a little bit too discrete. Like it's thinking about different psychiatric illnesses in terms of like you are this or you're not. Or I think that we're going to have this kind of revolution where we start to understand the continuum of all the different kind of axes of variance in psychiatry, and then we'll start to think about these disorders probably as more continuous things and things that are mixed, and then that will influence the way that we treat them, because we'll have a better understanding of any individual's, the distribution of their, you know, psychiatric conditions. So I mean, concrete examples that are interesting are like using EEG for, on the side of psychiatry, for understanding whether or not people are responsive to ECT, electroconvulsive therapy.
And what's EEG?
EEG is kind of the thing you referred to before of like electrodes on the scalp.
Oh, yes.
So you measure like the electrical activity that is being conducted from the surface of the brain out to the surface of the scalp.
Oh.
Which is something that I'm very interested in, because I think it's like a really powerful, non-invasive measuring, like functional neuroimaging technology. But yeah, I mean, there is an interesting study that showed with reasonably high accuracy that you can predict whether or not someone's responsive to ECT, which is really great, because that's like, it can be really effective, but it's also quite a complicated and risky procedure. So deciding, you know, if someone's going to be responsive to it without having to, you know, with high accuracy, without having to do anything too complicated, is great. Similarly, like different responsiveness to different ADHD medications. On like the neurodegenerative side of things, like understanding, you know, if somebody is like pre-Alzheimer's or where they are in the kind of neurodegenerative process without having to, you know, do a biopsy or do anything really complicated. These are all really exciting, like short-term applications of this technology that I could see being used in clinics, you know, in the next few years.
Capital intensive.
As a startup founder, you're juggling multiple priorities, from the expected, like finding product market fit, to the unexpected, like customer requests for SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification. Achieving compliance is time-consuming, and time spent on that is time away from the needs of the business, and that's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one solution for startups to come compliant quickly and build a security foundation with ease. With a combination of automation, an extensive partner network, and a security marketplace containing 385+ pre-built integrations, Vanta provides the necessary tools and expertise for startups to achieve compliance seamlessly, no matter how urgent your needs are, and at every phase of growth. Over 10,000 leading companies, including CipherStash, Handle, and Indebted, trust Vanta to automate compliance so they can focus on growing the needs of their business. Here is the important part. Startup listeners of the show get $1,000 off if they go to dayone.fm/blink.
Not necessarily. I think that we're kind of bottlenecked by model quality at the moment, which is okay. The thing that I'm working on. And what I'm interested in is how do you make these models much more reliable, more generalizable across people? Because EEG, I think as a technology has gotten a bad rap because it's really noisy. And, there's a lot of the signal to noise ratio is quite low. There's, obviously it's you're quite far removed from actual brain cells firing in some sense. But I think that the answer to that is get more sophisticated models and use these kind of more and more powerful models to dampen out the noise and extract the signal and generalize across people. And I think that we're at the point now where people are starting to apply the learnings from large language models, which is train big models, big deep neural networks at scale with lots and lots of data. And you get this really, really large increase in model performance and generalizability.
Could talk to you for 3 hours on this, but we are at our spicy rapid fire questions
that
we do at the end of the show.
Yep.
You have to answer these in 15 seconds or less.
Yep.
I won't time you. It's okay. Safe space.
Avoid.
And I've added
seconds.
One that you don't know based on your last answer.
Okay.
Surprise.
Is that going to come at the end or the beginning?
Right now.
Okay.
You ready?
Yep.
Seeing Neuralink's going after this, will Grok be the best model to use? I told you it was spicy.
I don't know.
15 seconds or less.
Maybe if they integrate these things, if they have the kind of communication between companies successfully. But other companies, if this technology becomes more advanced, other companies will come up, and then labs will partner with companies, and I think that. The lead might disappear. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question.
Thank you. What kinds of diseases do you think AI will solve before scientists?
At some point, all of the, I think we're just going to get to the point where there won't be diseases that become cured that don't in some way involve machine learning and artificial intelligence.
Your previous role was at Aussie darling edtech company SimConverse. Mm-hmm. Some of my favorite engineers come out of that company. You were recommended to me from a previous engineer out of that company. How are they attracting the best talent?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to this. One is just do something interesting, be an interesting company that's using cutting edge technology. And allows, then kind of requires the best engineers, but also excites the best engineers to work there because they get to do the interesting things. And then also just as a founder, when I met Aiden, I was kind of blown away by how intelligent and strategically minded he was. And I think that, leaves a big impact on people. You want to work for people who you admire intellectually.
Especially if you could work at Google or OpenAI or elsewhere.
Mm.
I'm sure that problem to solve and founder matters, right?
Yeah.
Who's the smartest AI engineer in Australia?
When he's here, Ethan Smith.
I know Ethan Smith. Why is he the smartest, do you reckon?
He just has this incredible, he's more of a researcher and an AI researcher, ML researcher, but he just has this incredible intuition for how these things work, and he's kind of relentless in building understanding. And yeah, I've never had conversations with someone where I'm like, wow, you really just see these things so clearly in your mind.
He never told me he was the smartest engineer
in
Australia.
He's so humble. He's so humble. Incredibly humble. It's very impressive.
Wow. He's about to get so many DMs. All right, last question. Actually, two. Sorry, I lied. What companies in neuroscience and startups in the space are people sleeping on? We know about Neuralink, but is there anyone that you're like, people should be more aware of this?
I mean, in Australia, Neuroad, I think they're a really exciting company doing interesting things.
They're hardware, right?
Yep. Yeah, they build their own hardware.
Amazing.
I mean, I think that like a lot of it's very nascent, but like in Australia, Synchron, in America, Forest, Neurotech, they're doing some really interesting stuff with a new technology or an emerging kind of technology called TFUS, which is really cool. I'm a sucker for this company called Prophetic in the US. I think they're doing like the kind of dream that they're selling is very interesting. Dream, like pun not intended, is very interesting.
They're doing dream stuff?
They're building a headset that uses like ultrasonic pulses to induce lucid dreams.
Oh, I want that.
Yeah, right?
It would really want that.
Like a qualitative change to your life to be like, be able to reliably do that without having to like, you know, do all the...
Josh, I'm reading fantasy novels before bed and I still can't lucid dream. It's really rude. I've been doing it for years.
You have to do this like insane practice where you... I mean, there's lots of different ways to do it, but it's like, you know, you have to be like reality checking while you're awake. And I mean, I know people who have successfully gotten to the point where they can reliably lucid dream, but it was a lot of work.
No, I need just someone to like...
Yeah, put a headset on. Exactly. Well, it's literally just like you wear like a band on your head. But I mean, it's not a product yet. But they're building it and it looks really cool. And the research is there.
I'm fascinated by that. Last one, I wear a Fitbit equivalent. Mm-hmm. A lot of people do tracks. For me, I like to know my step count, sometimes heart rate, sleep quality. There's things that I look for.
Mm-hmm.
Will people have brain trackers and what do you think they would like to track if they could?
Yeah, I think that there's going to be a huge kind of wearables for neural signals market, like just considering how popular like Fitbit and Apple Watch are, I think, you know, I mean, Apple could come out with a product eventually and people would use it.
They'd just buy it.
Yeah. I think getting things like how distracted are you throughout the day? Presence would be an interesting thing. Like how much are you actually paying attention to the world around you and actively involved in it versus like, you know, in your own head ruminating or things like that. And then maybe
great for meditation, right?
Yeah. Well, and but just great for like for the goal of meditation, which is to be more present, right? Maybe like attentiveness as well when you're working, like letting you know when you're in an environment that is like not conducive to you doing well, or what kind of things allow you to like, you know, be at your best when you're at work and things like that.
That reminds me of my body battery. That's a statistic and sometimes I check and it's like it's really low. No wonder I'm not thinking properly. Mm. I'd love a brain battery.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, and those things, like, they'll be integrated together, right? Because, like, the body battery, I mean, like, if you're not feeling well on some level, that's, it's also something that's happening inside your brain, right? And, yeah, you're kind of inferring that based on things that, you know, that are physiological signals from your body, but now you'll have like, oh, how is your brain actually operating?
Heard it here first. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank
Seriously
you.
Blew my mind. No pun intended. Where can people find you? Your LinkedIn's very sparse, Josh. Do you want people to discover you on there or not? people to connect with you on there?
Yeah, sure. Yep.
So when you have a big announcement, people will be ready and waiting, right?
Yep. And it will, I'll do it on LinkedIn.
Deal. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you for listening to In the Blink of AI. You can check out the show notes for anything discussed in this week's episode, and we will be back next week. This podcast was produced by Day One, with music by Dan Hansen and visual artwork by Sophie Tyrell. If you loved the episode, please tell your mates. And I love AI news. Please share your thoughts and suggestions to GeorginaRoseHealy@gmail.com.